and welcome to A Clock and Talk, an Arsenal podcast. I am joined here today by my friend Tony. How are you doing, Tony?
I'm not too bad, thanks. Yourself?
Doing pretty well. And we have a special guest on today from our friends at Gunners in the USA. We have Gunnar in Denver, Andy. How are you doing, Andy?
I'm good. Thank you for having me today. It's a pleasure and an honor to be on with you guys.
Well, we've been trying to work things out for a few weeks now at this point, I must say. And in fact, before Christmas, when Mike and I had a word, and you know, he said we should get you in line, but I know you keep busy, so we're glad that we could catch you on this weekday and talk some footy.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thanks a lot for being flexible with your schedules, guys.
For sure. I'm glad to have you on. So before we get right into the Chelsea game, I thought it'd be fun for our listeners to get to know a little bit more about you and about how you stumbled upon this magnificent and hauntingly beautiful club that is Arsenal. So you want to let us know a little bit about what Gunnar in Denver really did and how Gunners in the USA came about?
Yeah, so I've lived in Denver for 6 years. I've lived in America now for about 20. I was born and raised in England, grew up relatively close to where Arsenal trained, and I think they were the biggest Premier League side closest to my hometown. And I was just raised around a lot of Arsenal supporters. One particular family had two older sons that I just idolized, and they were both big Gunners. And so they kept giving me kits as they grew out of them, and I grew up an Arsenal supporter. But my dad tried as best as he could to get me to support West Ham, where he played as a youth. I've just always loved Arsenal since I can ever remember. So been a supporter now since I believe 93 was the first match I ever saw on TV, and it's just been for me ever since.
Wow. Well.
And then to answer your question of Gunners in the USA, Mike and I were out in California for the preseason tour 2 years ago, and he and I met briefly through Facebook, a group that was kind of set up of people that we knew mutually, and we just hit it off. And then when we got to California, we had a couple days together. And then really, I just got the idea to start a podcast from the U.S. perspective. I'd never really listened to many U.S. pods, and there are a bunch now, and they're all great. But we just kind of started it and met some great people along the way that helped us get started and ramped up our fan base. And so it's been a year and a half now, and we've loved doing it ever since. It's just been so much fun.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm glad that you didn't creep into the other half of London and become a West Ham supporter, because that would be utter misery for you. Not to say it's not been miserable for the last few years for us either, but wow, that would be a different rabbit hole altogether.
It is, and it's funny because my cousin, who still lives in England, is an Everton supporter, and he keeps saying to me, "You just don't know how bad, how good you have it." And I said, "It's different levels, you know, it's different levels." But yeah, it's always good for the banter, at least.
Fantastic. So we asked our listeners to send in a few questions, and you know what they wanted to know about you. So we've of course gone over Gunners in the USA, and that's a big part of. You know, of the whole Arsenal part of your fandom. But these are some questions that we thought, you know, you would like to answer that our listeners have sent in directly. So this is from at the Arsview, and he goes right in for the throat with, first he welcomes you and he says, "Are you Wenger in or Wenger out? And who is the best candidate for replacing Wenger?"
Yeah, I saw that. It's hard to say that. I know this sounds stupid, but I don't want to classify myself as in or out, because I don't want to jump on that train. And I think Mike and I have always done a good job with our podcast of being frustrated, but never kind of going down that path. I will say this, for more than 5-6 years now, I've wanted change. And I think the change that I've always kind of wanted has been what we're now seeing with Ivan hiring Raul and Sven and allowing them to take care of business. I have always said Wenger's got too much on his plate. To answer the question, I would say I'm Wenger out by definition, because I feel like we need a change. And we've been told, you know, on our pod by numerous journalists and people who have interviewed players, there's just no setup when it comes to coaching. There's no freedom for coaches. And so for me, I feel like we have gotten the best out of the guy, and he's revolutionized our club, and he deserves a statue, irregardless of what has happened in the last 10 seasons. Delivering the FA Cups, you still have to – you're still playing for trophies. But I'm an advocate for a new manager coming in. I think the best option for us would have been Pep, because the system and the style of play completely suits him. You know, this sounds completely crazy, but you almost have to look at the system and style of a Bournemouth. I mean, Eddie Howe could probably slot right in, but doesn't have that experience and tenure. So I would look at Simeone, or God knows what's going to happen in Madrid. So maybe Zidane come in. I don't know. But for me, I just love pissing Mike off. For me, I think the next manager who comes in needs to be able to manage the ego, and needs to actually hold fire underneath the players' asses, because I feel like we have a manager right now who lets them get away with murder, and we need someone who's going to hold players accountable and make them push and strive to be the best player they can be.
I think you'll find no arguments on that on this pod. And actually, that segues into another question, which is from Glenn, who's a regular listener, and he's also very gracious in welcoming you to the pod first. Wow, it's amazing how wonderful our listeners are. You usually don't come across people like that on Twitter. But he says that imagine you are Stan Kroenke for a season, or you replace Stan Kroenke for a season. What are the immediate changes that you will make?
Yeah, so this was funny because we asked this pod or this question on our pod probably last season, and the first thing I would do is I would change the atmosphere at the Emirates. I would probably get a group of supporters together who have been going to the club, going to home matches for a long time, short time, and get people in a room. And I would change the atmosphere. I would put people together who want to sing. I'd put people together who just want to enjoy. I'd put young children in a section where they have the opportunity to become lifelong supporters. We have a lot of supporters who travel from overseas. I've been to a couple matches sitting in the Arsenal America section. And those supporters, while they love Arsenal, they might not sing and they might not get into the atmosphere. And so put those together. And so that would be my first thing, is I would change the atmosphere, lower ticket prices. And then I think I would just adjust everything from coaches down. But the first question, the first response, honestly, is change the Emirates atmosphere.
So are we talking more Anfield here, or are we talking more Eastern European ultras here?
Dortmund.
Fantastic. Okay, let's not call it Anfield.
I was in England for the Leicester match that Friday night to kickstart the season, and the atmosphere was tremendous. But it was just the matter of the match, right? All the goals going in, us coming back. But for the longest time, I've been to the Emirates where it's just been boring, and you literally sit there and it is like a library. So for me, that would be the first thing I would do.
Fantastic. His next question is, what is your long-term vision for the club?
So Champions League, right? And here's the thing. The long-term vision for any football club, and I say this being related to a lot of people who don't support clubs like Arsenal who get to finals, it's not only stability, but it's the history. It's the challenging of trophies for long-term. I mean, it's all well and good that we've won all these FA Cups, but at the end of the day, you want to be in for a shout for the Premier League. And even if you're not going to win it every season, but remember back in the late 90s, early 2000s, when it was always us and United, and then the Chelsea's kind of rolled in, we were always in with a shout. And you almost want to be a club where you get to April and you're still involved. And maybe you only win it once out of every 5 years, but at least you're there. And I feel like with us, we're just a club where February rolls around and we think, okay, well, we've got a cup run, you know? So I think that's the longevity, is always being in the mix.
Yeah, it's been a challenge, especially in the last year and a half. So there's going to be no arguments on that from me or Tony either. Our next question is from @RealAdamCohen, and he asks, do you wear pants while watching football?
What a weird question. Is that like a normal thing to ask someone?
Well, I left out a key word from there because at the end he said discuss. Now, I don't know if you want to discuss that. So I just put the first part of the question to you. But no, that's not something people ask each other.
You know, most of my attire when I watch football, because, and you know, I mean, a 7 a.m. kickoff for you is a 5 a.m. kickoff for me. So I literally roll out of bed in my pajamas, turn the TV on and watch the match. If it's a 9 a.m. or later, maybe I'll get down to the pub. Typically, they make you wear pants when you walk in. So I'm going to answer that as yes.
Fantastic. Our next question is from David, who's at Most Certainty, and he asks, at American bars, do they serve pints with crisps or bottles with potato chips?
So we have pints with donuts because the matches are so early that we have a fan group, the Denver Gooners, it's run by a guy named Drew who's awesome, but he will pick up donuts, and we'll usually tailgate with beer and donuts before the match.
Well, bless the man who brings donuts, am I right?
Seriously, right?
Our next question is from @CEDScout, and he asks, what are your highest and lowest points as an Arsenal fan, and why?
Highest points, I think, were Champions League final. Lowest points, I've got two, and I'll go through them quickly. The first one is when Thierry Henry left. I remember the same day I broke up with a girl named Emily. Somehow my mother found out, called me to ask me if I was okay, and I literally responded to her, I just can't believe he's gone. This is the worst day of my life. And she said, I was talking about Emily. And I was like, well, I'm not. I don't care about that. Thierry Henry just left. And then the second one would be 2001 when Michael Owen scored a brace in the FA Cup final. It was the day of my prom. I didn't smile in a single photo. It ruined the entire day for me. And so those were the two lowest points.
Wow, that second one really hit. So no denying that one. our next question comes from @TexasGooner, and he has a couple as well. His first is, which Arsene Wenger catchphrase annoys you the most? You know, handbrakes.
Like a new signing. Like a new signing.
I think Tony agrees with that one for sure. And Texas Gooner's next question is, most underrated AFC player of all time?
Wow, that's a really good question. You know, you almost have to throw currently Nacho in that conversation because I think he's always been that player who's played well for us. And I was guilty of this. You always just expected Gibbo to overtake him. Young English player, speed, passion for the club. And we had a lot of left backs kind of in the mix, and they just, no one's ever uprooted him from that position. And then the tank comes in, and you think to yourself, right, here's a Bundesliga player of the year, but Nacho keeps finding his way into the team. And now look at him. I mean, he's absolutely just he's replacing Alexis Sanchez, you know, and he'll be our leading goal scorer by March. But no, I think Nacho's in that conversation. I think, for me, Podolski would be in the conversation if he got to play more, but we never really got to see the full Podolski. But no, I wouldn't say Nacho. I really think he's the most underrated because if you go to the Emirates, how often do you see Monreal on the back of his shirt? But the impact he has on our club is huge.
Yeah, especially this season. I think someone tweeted out after the game that it's sad that in today's time, defenders have to sort of be praised only if they're scoring or assisting. I think Azpilicueta is a good example because he's been assisting some goals or has been earlier in the season for Morata. And I think that sort of, you know, of course, Aspi is a great defender, but what Nacho Monreal has done for Arsenal in recent months, I think, is a similar parallel. And he's only been getting praised more recently because he's been on the score sheet.
Well, and if you look at just the, you know, he was thrown in as a center back for the majority of the beginning of the season. That's not his natural position. And he's been found out a couple times, but, you know, he's going in and he's doing the work. And for someone that doesn't naturally grow up and play that role, it's incredible. And then where we're lacking goals, he's stepping up and scoring them and maybe getting a little lucky, but he's finding himself in the right position. And so you got to praise him for that.
for sure, for sure. We'll talk about Nacho more when we come to the Chelsea game. But our final two questions are from members of the CET family, from the Cluck and Talk family themselves. And the first one is, who do you have or who would you want to have on the back of your shirt?
So I bought the new third strip with Lacazette this summer. Last season I got Xhaka. I'm kind of, you know what, I've said to myself that I'm not going to put a name on the back of my shirt going forward unless Wilshire signs. I've got a Wilshire 19 and a Wilshire 10, and I feel like for me now there's no love or passion from players that haven't grown up in the club. And so I just feel that, within today's transfer window and today's transfer, like I have two Alexis Sanchez shirts. I can't wear those again.
Never.
Like, when is it going to be okay for me to wear that shirt? Like, it's gone to waste. And so I feel like with Wilshire, even if he eventually did leave the club, you know, whether it's because we don't give him a new contract or what, I just feel like he's Arsenal through and through. But I've also, and I'll ask you guys this, is it okay to buy today's shirt with a legend on the back? So a Bergkamp, an Henry, a Perez. Would you guys do that?
Tony, you want to take that one first?
The only time I've ever done it is when the last year at Highbury, we had the red currant shirt, and I got Ian Wright on the back. I don't see anything against it, but it's just generally not the done thing.
Yeah.
To be honest, when I'm in the ground, I don't like when, say, we sing Henri's name, and it's nothing against Henri. It's not because I don't like Henri, but I'm there to support the current team as I have, and as I supported the team when Henri was in it, and as I supported the team before Henri was in it. So I see my role as a supporter is to try and be the 12th man and whatnot. And if I'm cheering for a player or shouting the name of a player that's not on the pitch, I don't know how much that does. Obviously, it's better than sitting there in silence, but I would rather sing Granit Xhaka's song than Thierry Henry's if Granit Xhaka's on the pitch. And I kind of feel the same way about shirts. Not, I know obviously the players don't see who's on the back of my shirt, but I feel like I'm there to support the current team. So I personally wouldn't do it.
For me, I think it's a conversation piece. So if I walk into a public setting and if I see someone wearing an Arsenal shirt, and I, you know, being the natural thing as you would do as a football fan is trying to peep and see, you know, who they got on the back. And if it's a new jersey and it's got someone from 2005, let's say, on it, I think it'd be fun conversation. And at the stadium as well, if you're walking around and you're just seeing, you know, Alexis Sanchez or Mesut Ozil jerseys, it's probably not the most entertaining thing. So I think it's a good conversation piece. I would personally never do it, but I can see why people would.
What you're also forgetting is that, like, we're in London and Londoners don't talk to each other. It's an unwritten rule. Just stare at each other in silence and judge anyone for making noise. So there's no such thing as a conversation starter unless someone's literally saved your life. And even then you said nod.
That's true. I think I'm just being a little more utopian in that sense then.
Yeah. I get your points.
For sure. Andy, your last question once again from the CET family is, who, in your opinion, is the biggest Judas?
All time or right now?
Let's go.
All time. It was me that asked the question, so all time.
It's a really good question because there's so many. You know, I'm almost going to say Alex Ferguson.
Wow.
Because he was such a good manager. He was the wrong manager during our heyday. He was the wrong person to be opposite Arsene. I think if any other manager was at United, I don't think they would have been as good, and we would have won a lot more trophies. But then I'd also almost put Abramovich in that conversation as well, because, again, without him, we would have been a completely different club. You know, but Ferguson's the first one that comes to mind. And I'll tell you what, I hated him when he was the manager, but I respect him so much. And I've read a couple of his books because I coach on a smaller level. And he's a genius. But I think he was the perfect opposition for Arsene. But without him, we would have won way more.
I'm going to be honest. I didn't expect that answer. And I was hoping.
Who are you guys' answers?
Well, I was just going to say Fabregas because I wanted to start talking about the Chelsea game. So I thought if you say Fabregas, that would be the perfect way to get into that. But I'm interested to hear what Tony thinks.
So when, as I said, it was me that asked this question, and when I asked it, the person that came... Well, first off, because obviously I know a few of the backstories through working in football, I was interested to see if people would say sort of people like Van Persie, who in a way gave the club the option to keep him there. And obviously the club didn't fulfil his ambition or whatnot. So I was interested in that. But mine would be Adebayor without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah, he'd be up there. Ashley Cole would be up there. For me, Cesc isn't in the conversation because I feel like he had the opportunity to go home. He didn't leave for Sanchez or Ashley Cole for money. He left to go to a club that he grew up supporting,
and so he went on strike.
Well, and he did, and he did it in a kind of a shitty way, but he knew what, he went home, and so for that I give him a pass. But now that I'm thinking about it, Ashley Cole would definitely be up there.
See, I wouldn't put Ashley Cole up there, because if someone said, like, forget the figures, because obviously football is, we deal with obscene figures, but if someone says to you in your job, I'm going to pay you £1,000 a week, and you go, yep, fine, and then the contract comes over and it's 10 or 20% less, you're going to be thinking, hang on, they're taking the piss a bit here. And that is essentially what happened. And then after that, yeah, it got his head turned, and then he did do some things that were wrong. I'm not trying to defend him, but I think we was at fault for the initial head turning, whereas I think Adebayor was just an arsehole the whole way through.
Yeah, I completely agree. With Ashley, it was just the whole hotel situation and everything that happened there. But I'll still stick with my answer as with Sir Alex, because I just feel like without him, we would have just been a completely different club with more trophies, probably a little bit further in European competition. I don't know. I think it would have been different.
I agree.
Well, I'm just surprised there's no mention of Stan Kroenke in all this conversation. But moving on swiftly, we're going to Wembley, boys. And
we are.
And we had a fantastic game yesterday. Well, some might call it fantastic. Some might call it a game of two halves. But a full-strength lineup from what's available. And going into the second leg, we just had to get a result. We had to make sure that we did the job in the first leg, which we did. And this game was at the Emirates. So let's start with Tony here. And Tony, let's get your thoughts on the lineup and what you were thinking before going into the game.
Well, yeah, I mean, I saw the lineup, and anyone that follows us on Twitter, first of all, thank you for putting up with my nonsense. But I tweeted before the game that not the lineup, well, the lineup and the shape was all wrong. I feel this Chelsea side that, even last season, and especially this season, where they're not as good as they were, you still have to match them up for shape, because they're very clever. And I don't want to go too deep tactically, but they're free up front, play very narrow, and they occupy the centre-backs. And if you're only playing with two centre-backs, the full-backs then need to tuck in to provide cover. So you've got all four of your defenders covering their three attackers, being William, Pedro and Hazard last night. And then Alonso and Moses are just sort of standing on their own. If you're only playing a four at the back, because your fullbacks are tucked in, and I just, for me, it seems like one, common knowledge, and two, absolute basics that you have to match them up. Like yesterday, we were forced into a back five in the first half with Alex Iwobi playing essentially left wing back. And look, I'm not his biggest fan, but I can't really blame him, because he didn't know where he was meant to be standing, what he was meant to be doing. He's never played as a left wing back. It wasn't like he'd trained in that role when he was played there, and he knew he was going to play there. He was forced into playing in that role because of the, I'll say it as a Wenger mistake, because it's very rare you'll see Chelsea beaten when you're not matched up for them. And we've had really good results against them, and a lot of people are saying Wenger's got Conte's number, and it's hard to disagree with that. But every single one of them games, we've matched them up for shape, except away at Stamford Bridge last season, when it was the one game we lost. So when we beat them at home 3-0, they hadn't changed shape yet. So we matched them up shape for shape. Then we didn't any away game loss. And then in the FA Cup final, Community Shield, away game at Stamford Bridge, home game at the Emirates a few weeks ago, and the away game in the league at Stamford in the first leg a few weeks ago, we matched them up shape for shape, and we've never really looked in any danger. So I thought it was a really, really bad, not so much the players in the lineup, but I thought the shape was just, I'll go so far as to say it was an amateur error, to be honest.
Andy, the first half was sloppy too. I mean, Tony just spoke about that and alluded to that fact. Did you think after we equalized we could carry on from here, or did you think we needed a tactical shift, which would probably happen in the at halftime?
Definitely needed a tactical shift, as Tony said. It was a big error, and I think that the tactical shift did happen, but after the goal went in, they were still all over us, and our defense just looked out of sorts. I mean, they were shaky, they were playing a high line, they were letting all kind of things come through the back, and so I thought to myself after. I think they had a goal called for offside. I think Pedro scored before Hazard,
right,
a couple minutes before. I just thought to myself, this is going to be a long day if this is how we're going to play. And so seeing that tactical change at halftime was, even though slight, it was enough to go toe-to-toe with them. And on paper, when you go toe-to-toe with them, we line up very well. So, yeah, the tactical change was brilliant.
Is the exclusion of Kolasinac something that we should talk about? Because we know he's been carrying a knock, and he did make a cameo at the end. But why is it that if Kolasinac is not going to be starting, then not throw Maitland-Niles in there? What do you think the process was there, Andy?
I still, and we talked about this on our pod, and I'm just going to echo what I said. He is, I think, carrying an injury, and he's probably not 100%. I think that we've seen the likes of Wilshere and Rambo get rushed back a little too quickly. We have a new medical staff now, so you see the players come out doing different warm-ups. You see them come out doing sprints right as the game starts. And so I think this medical staff is saying to Arsene, we need to hold these players back a little bit longer, and he's seeing that with Rambo and Wilshere, who have gone these long stretches without massive injury. I know Rambo has just had a layoff, but before then he was playing quite a bit. So I think it's purely based off of injury, fingers crossed, because he is such a good player. But that's my whole thought behind it, is it's got to be injury related.
Yeah, and I mean, speaking of injuries, I think that brings us to our first goal that we conceded, and Koscielny and Mustafi completely. You know, not in accordance with each other, and a gaping hole through the middle of them, and Hazard latches onto it and finishes. Tony, what's going on with Koscielny? Do we seriously need to look at possibly two center backs come this summer?
I'm just going to comment on the goal first, and again, it comes down to the same tactical error I just spoke about, because whoever played the ball for, I think it was Pedro, but it might have been William, dropped short. And Koscielny half went to go with him, but they still had two, being either Willian or Pedro, the one that didn't play the ball, and Hazard up top. So our two centre-backs were outnumbered. So it's one of them. It looks like a mistake from Koscielny, because he kind of half went, and it is a mistake. But I feel it came about due to poor tactics. But, yeah, I mean, like, he's getting worse every week. He's not getting worse every week, but he's... Every time I see him play, it becomes harder to imagine him as that sort of colossus he was 12 months ago. So is he okay for a game every week? Probably, but when the schedule gets a bit busier, I don't feel as assured with him anymore. So do we need to look for other players? Yeah, but I mean, even if he didn't have his injury issues, his age is catching up with him. He's never gonna get any quicker. He's probably not gonna get any stronger. So, we'll go into it later. But we're rumored to be looking at Johnny Evans, and it looks like a deal could be done there. And that would sort of make sense, because a lot of people would maybe argue they don't want Johnny Evans starting every week for a club like Arsenal. But if you had him filling in, him and Koscielny sort of rotated and played every other game. If there was no injuries, then that would sort of make a lot more sense, because there's no way the current Koscielny can be playing every mm-hmm. game. He's just not up to it.
Yeah, and I mean, someone with whom age is not catching up is Senor Nacho Monreal. Quite a pinball goal, if I would. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. And Rudiger's expression and reaction to that was quite beautiful too. I mean, Andy's just spoken about how he's probably his most underrated Arsenal player of all time, but he's got to be our player this season, with maybe Ramsey in a shout, right, Tony?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's Nacho. To be honest, for me, it was Nacho last season as well. I think I've said this on this podcast before. He gives you a 7 or 8 every week, and mm-hmm. the problem with that is a 7 or 8 is usually not enough to get you man in a match. But I would prefer someone who's 7 or 8 every week than a than an Alexis who was 10 one week and 4 the next. And I think that's the issue that Nacho has. And you compared him to Aspilicueta, and I've done that a lot on this podcast because I see them as very, very similar players, albeit opposite foot. One's right footed, one's left footed. But I think they both slot very well into the flanks of a back three, as in the third centre back, because they can come out with the ball, they're quick, and their delivery's okay. And then they're both very good fullbacks and wingbacks. I see them as very similar players. And as you said, Aspilicueta seems to have been getting praised for quite a while now, probably because their defence is a bit more solid than ours. Whereas Monreal seems to sort of only be getting the praise, as you said, since he's been getting involved in the goals more. Interestingly, considering he's mainly played from centre back this season, this is his highest scoring run with the club, highest scoring season already. And obviously, we're just about halfway through.
Yeah, who needs Alexis, right? Right, Andy, when we have Nacho Monreal banging in the gold.
Ballon d'Or finalist. You heard it here first.
Ballon d'Or finalist for sure. speaking of defensive players, Andy, I have a question for you, and this involves N'Golo Kanté. How much do you think he hates Mesut Ozil, considering he's never one-upped him? Maybe once.
You know what? I think last season, was it where Ozil turned and Kanté fell and it became like this great meme? But Kanté is the player that we've wanted at Arsenal for years and years, just that absolute nip at your heels, get in your way. But there's something with Ozil where his movement into space, his ability to see a pass before he even receives his ball, kills players like Kanté because the vision isn't there. You know, Kanté is a very great, is a little bit like Xhaka. When the player's right in front of you and you need to stop him, he's great. But the moment that player has any creativity, it's over for him, and Ozil has his number, and it's great to see. And I think that if we do lose Ozil, we're going to I think we're going to reflect on him in a couple years from now and just see how truly great he is, because the number of passes and his ability to see play three or four passes before it happens is why Kanté can't keep up with him.
Yeah, I mean, Tony tweeted out something along the lines of this, that he doesn't understand why people don't rate Mesut Ozil. Tony, do you want to touch upon what motivated that, apart from just the performance? What caught your eye especially?
He's kind of agreeing with what Andy said. He's just one or two steps ahead of not only the other team, ahead of us, which can cause problems at times, but he plays football on a whole different level. Like, I've seen some people give him man of the match yesterday, and I'll be honest, I didn't think he was, but he was on a different wavelength. Like, I think my words were he was on a different planet, and I think that's the best way to describe him. It's almost like he's playing a different game.
Like, there was a picture 2 seasons ago. We were playing West Ham at home. And,
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, and everyone on the pitch was looking at the ball heading to Ozil, and it was like you could see his look, and they graphed it out. You see him looking across the pitch to a wide open Arsenal player. So while everyone is looking at Ozil receiving the ball, he's already thinking, dude's way, I've already got him. And you can see the ball in flight heading to him. Is that the one that you're thinking about, Tony?
Yeah, and to be honest, I actually think he made the wrong decision, but I know exactly what you're talking
about. Yeah, no, exactly. But it's that Ozil that he'd see something completely different than everyone else. And whether or not it's a good decision or not, that's just his brain, and that's where the likes of a Kanté can't keep up with him because he's just too advanced. And you always talk about soccer brain, and for me, he's probably got one of the best of them. You know, and you sometimes see it with Jack, and Fabregas would be in that conversation, but he's got that Iniesta type of just being able to pinpoint a pass that no one else is seeing, and it's incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I could go on and on about Mesut Ozil, and you know it would take weeks for us to finish the podcast then. But all I'll say in closing on Mesut Ozil is that Jose Mourinho once said that there's no single copy of him, not even a bad one. And I think that that's basically what we're trying to say here, that he's just so different than all football players, that things he sees are something we can't even appreciate. So soak it all in while it lasts, and let's hope that it lasts longer than just this year. Back to the Chelsea game, something I noticed in particular was the rotational fouling that Bakayoko and Kanté and some of their other defensive players were partaking in. It bothers me so much when you know players don't get carded for the right reasons, and especially when we've got, had so many refereeing decisions go against us this season. Andy, were you pulling your hair out when N'Golo Kanté kept fouling Jack Wilshere and didn't get booked at all?
Maybe I think I tweeted, like, yeah, I think I tweeted this, that was his 16th foul, and he still hadn't gotten a card. And you guys are probably watching, or Schwinn, you're probably watching the same feed I was. Even the commentators over here were saying, well, enough's enough now. This is like his fourth in a row in a short time frame. But oftentimes a player fouls another player because they are getting their pocket picked. They can't stop them from doing what they want to do without fouling them. And so, again, Kanté was found out, and he had another poor match against us. And I don't know if it's Arsene saying to his midfield pairs, hey, this is how he plays. We've got him dialed down to a T, or if it's just he was having an off night. But, you know, to me, there were a lot of offsides yesterday, and there were a few where I was thinking, all right, that's real close. And so you kind of felt like Chelsea were getting the fair end from the referees, but yeah, you know, it's sour grapes. We won. But yeah, there was definitely a little bit more fouling on their side of the ball, and it didn't really come through that the ref really cared to show them a card, which is frustrating.
Yeah, and I mean, Tony, you were in the stadium, and from the feed that I was watching, I could tell that the Emirates would, you know, try and almost coax a card out of the referee after a certain point. I mean, one, it's Jack Wilshere, so you know that's of course something that always bothers us. Every time he goes down, there's a concern. But even Mesut Ozil, I mean, you were saying before the podcast that even he was, you know, being rotationally fouled. What needs to be done? I mean, Arsene Wenger has said so many things about referees, and he's probably only going to get into trouble. But what do you think is the reason that there's no one ever being questioned when it comes to fouling our players?
Yeah, I mean, I'd start off by saying that I'm a big advocate of rotational fouls. I think it annoys me that we don't do it more often. As annoying as it is when it happens against us, it's a part of the game. In terms of why teams get away with it, there's a few things. I mean, Kanté, it was six fouls, and he should have been booked. There's no two ways about it. But he was – none of them were even – like, we have an orange – like, the term orange card is about between a yellow and a red. But none of them Kanté fouls are even half a yellow card, really. And I think that's why he got away with it. And I'm not saying it's right, but I think that's why he got away with it. He should have got it on the totting up process. But I think every time sort of Oliver thought, well, that's not enough for a yellow. That's not enough for a yellow. And he got away with it. And also, I've discussed this with you before, that players get certain tags that they're that type of player. And usually it's a bad thing. But there's certain players, and that if someone's known as very strong, they can push someone off the ball, and it's definitely a foul. But because they're known as strong, it's they would just use their strength. And Kante's got that when he does break up like that, they go, oh, it's just what he does. And that doesn't mean it's not a booking or that it's right, but they do get away with things. He's one of the people that get away with things like that because he's that type of player.
Yeah, and it's very bothering. I mean, we've seen this time and again, and I just hope that, you know, we don't lose players to injury, because we're thin on our squad right now, and we do have a couple of players coming back. Ramsey's made a couple of cameos, and Giroud might be returning if he's not off to Germany. So it would be a loss to lose someone in midfield, especially Jack Wilshere or Mesut Ozil. Moving on to the second goal and the winning goal, scrappy. But we'll take it. Once again, Rudiger helping out a little bit. And instead of boom shakalaka, we have boom laka shaka. So can you talk me through that one?
Yeah, it's sloppy, but my first thought was Xhaka's creation of the goal to start and then his continuous run into the box after. When you go back and watch it on replay, he did what every player is taught to do. You don't let the play die. He kept moving forward. He kept pushing, and he was in the right position. Even when Lacazette received the ball, he kind of noticed, like, hey, if you've got the ball, then there's no striker here, so I need to get into that position. And so he was the fox in the box at that moment. But again, absolutely sloppy, very lucky. But you've got to give credit to Xhaka for being in that position, because most central midfielders, especially when they're supposed to be defensively minded, aren't going to get that high up the pitch. And he kept going, followed through with the play, and it resulted in a goal. And you can almost echo what Tony said earlier. Nacho is doing the same thing, being a center back. He's following through on his play. He's not thinking, I need to get back, and that might be bad, because I think in Liverpool we were exposed a couple times because of his forward movement. But he's following through on play, and that's why they're getting goals. So credit where credit's due.
I think Xhaka did very well, and I think it's one of those moments where, you know, you pop up into the box and you're able to slot it home with a little bit of a little bit of deflection as the ball finds you. But I think this is a good moment to maybe talk about Lacazette and what he brings to the game. We were all expecting a number nine, a predator, a fox in the box, and all those cliches that go with it. But he's been way more involved in games. Of course, you know, that Bournemouth game especially comes to mind when he was dropping very deep and Mesut Ozil was missing that day. But even yesterday, that it seemed that he was, as Tony said, that he was not hungry for goal. He was more hungry for the ball. And, I mean, being in the stadium, Tony, what was it that you saw of Lacazette? I know you keenly watch him and you want him to succeed as well, but it seemed like you were quite bothered by his performance yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, look, he's completely different to what I expected us to sign. He's a lot better footballer, and I think he surprised a lot of people by sort of how good he is at linking up and holding on to the ball and whatnot. And of course, we're going to get listeners say, oh, I knew that. You don't know what you're talking about. I've watched him for however long. But no one, I didn't see anyone tweet or even people I spoke to that he was that type of player. Everyone thought he was going to be the predator. What's annoying me is, look, he is a very good footballer and he does offer a lot to our build-up play, but it's like he sort of always wants to hang out on the edge of the box. So instead of making that last five-yard run where you find yourself at the near post or even at the back post or in the six-yard box, you look and he's never there. He's sort of, and whether that may be because he's coming short to link the play and then he doesn't, obviously it develops quickly and he's not got the speed, not because he's not quick, but just because he hasn't got the time to get up with play. But again, that's when you're playing with one striker, you have to be able to get in the box. I got quite a bit of criticism for that tweet last night. So I watched the game again and I took some pictures just of my TV on my phone of developing attacks where he was either the ball was wide and he's just standing on the edge of the box doing nothing when he should be busting the gut to get into that 6 yard box. Whether he's going to beat him in the air or not is regardless. You've got a chance of the ball falling to you there. Especially if you're the only striker, sometimes you've got to think for the team and not about how you can score. And then there's other attacks where the one where Iwobi missed was a prime example. Lacazette was on the halfway line out wide. And it's like, yeah, he's done good in the build-up for the team, but you're never going to score from there. You're not a threat to anyone. You're giving the defenders nothing to do. And that was on the counter-attack as well. I don't mean to criticise him. I just don't feel like he's a goal threat. I feel, had you swap the amount of minutes him and Giroud had got this season, I think Giroud would have scored more goals. Would we have been as good a team with our build-up players good? Probably not. But what we all thought and what we all said we needed as fans, and I'm assuming Arsene Wenger thought the same, was a goal scorer. We needed to get more goals in the team. And that's one thing I don't think he's added. I saw he's played 24 games, I think it is, with 21 starts. Granted, he's come off on 70 minutes with most of them, but I strongly feel that if you gave Giroud them that exact same set of circumstances, 70 minutes in 21 games or so, and then three sub appearances, he would have more than 9 league goals. I mean, I think he's got 3 or 4, and he's played less than a third of the minutes of Lacazette. So in less than a third of the minutes, he's got over a third of the goal, like well over a third of the goal. So for me, I just don't think he was what we thought he was going to be. I mean, and Pete, I've seen a lot of people say he's not getting the service. If you've got Jack and Ozil behind you and you're not getting the service, it's your fault. You're not making the right runs. Like, there's no, either that or you're telling me that Mesut Ozil can't create a chance. And if you're saying that, stop watching football because you don't understand what you're watching.
Andy?
I will say that, you know, there's a different Lacazette that plays when Ozil's on the pitch. When he has Iwobi and Welbeck, they're, you know, I don't think he has as much ability to receive the ball. Someone came on our pod, and I forget who it is because I want to give them credit, but they did this big research, and it was about strikers their first season in the Premier League. And I think Aguero was the only striker that came in from outside of the country that netted more than 20 goals in his first season. And so I know it's a cop-out, but I want to, you know, to say to Lacazette, hey, you're not what we thought you were, at this point, I think that's tough. if next season we're seeing the same thing, then I would agree with that. But I feel like it's so hard for some strikers when they move from Europe over to England, because the defenders are quicker, they hit harder, the referees don't call as much. And so I'd like to see him in a second season. But I agree with what Tony was saying with Giroud. We probably would have had some more goals, but your play and your build-up is a lot different. And I also wonder, too, and I'm not just saying this because he left, I don't know how Lacazette's going to change with Sanchez not in the team, because Sanchez loved to drop deep to receive the ball and drive at goal. And now we're going to see a different build-up where we're going to rely on Jack, Mesut, Ramsey a little bit more than having players just run at the D. So it's going to be interesting couple months to see what Lacazette's going to do, and especially if Aubameyang comes in, because God knows they're the same player. So are we going to go two up top, or one going to play and one going to sit? It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Just to sort of clarify my point, I agree that the first season in the Premier League is always horrible, and to get 20 goals is unbelievable. And look, he could still well and go and do that. And it's not my, as I said, I'm not saying he's not a good player, but my grievance is the positions he's taking him up. He's look, as you said, it is a much harder league, but the positions you take up are up to you. The opposition are almost irrelevant with the positions you take up. And he's just not in the position to score goals, which is what's worrying for me. And again, when I say he's not the player we thought we were signing, I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism. It's just that, as I said, a lot of us thought, or what we wanted or what we thought we needed, was a fox in the box. And he tends to not be in the box. So
And so I ask you, because I completely agree, do you feel like that might be why we bring Aubameyang in, to have Lacazette play solely as that in-the-box striker? Because his footwork is dangerous. I mean, the amount of penalties that he could win if he stays in the box, he's got fast feet, he's got a powerful shot. If you bring in Aubameyang, you say to him, hey, you can range, you've got the speed, the ability, and you can get the ball in. I don't really watch much German football, so I'm not going to claim to be an expert, but would that be why we're bringing in a second striker with speed, pace, and say to him, work together, utilize that space together? Oh, and you've got Mesut, you've got Jack, you've got Aaron, they'll just ping you balls. Just go out there and play.
And Mkhitaryan.
Yeah.
And Mkhitaryan, that's right. Forgot about him.
I see it the other way somewhat. I see that if Aubameyang comes in, that he hangs on the shoulder of the last defender. Defender's never going to be able to push up too high, which then if Lacazette wants to come short, it gives him too much space to it gives him much more space to work in. And he's also got someone ahead of him rather than our most attacking player being him, who tends to drop short. So I hear what you're saying, but I kind of see it the other way. And especially with, I mean, as you said, you don't watch much German football, and I don't watch loads, but I watch a bit. But with his goal record, Aubameyang, he's not that guy that comes short to allow space for others. In a way, you could see him as a bit selfish, because he plays on the last man. He uses his pace to get in behind. He's quite decent in the air. He's a big boy. And he's a numbers man, in terms of he may not be brilliant at times, but he gets goals. I mean, even this season, he's had loads of problems. I think it's 21 goals in 23 games. So he's not going to come in and think, I'll play 10 yards deeper because I've got the pace to make up that ground. He'll think, well, if I can make up 10 yards on the defender, I'll do it from off their shoulder and then I'll be 10 yards ahead of them. He's more that kind of, I don't want to say selfish because it sounds like a criticism, but I can't think of a better word, so I'm going to say he's more of a selfish type of player. But I think they will work in tandem, but I think it'll be the upper way to sort of how you just expressed it.
Mm.
If he comes in, by the way.
Yes.
Yeah, there's questions on that as well, and we'll, of course, talk about that whole saga going on and whether that's going to come to a close. But I think that leaves us for the Chelsea game. Good result, strong response. And we have a date with Man City now at Wembley for the final of a tournament that Arsene Wenger has never won. So let's see how that turns out and what happens with that. Finally, boys, we have received confirmation that Alexis Sanchez is no longer an Arsenal player. It's been put out on the web. It's been put out. The banner has been removed. The dogs are gone. I don't know why the dogs were so relevant during this whole these.
I think it was our last desperate attempt to keep the player.
I mean, there's a question mark on whether there should have been a banner, as you said, Andy. But even as you know, these past few days have rolled on, even after the transfer, Adam and Humber have really been in the papers, to say the least. But we welcome Henrik Mkhitaryan. I know me and Tony are excited for his arrival. Andy, what do you think of Mkhitaryan, and what are your thoughts on the deal overall?
I've always said that if we were going to do a deal, I'd prefer that we get a player coming the other way, because it at least adds depth to our squad. And I don't believe that Arsen would have dipped into the market to replace. I still don't, and I'm sure we'll get to this, I still don't think the Aubameyang thing is going to get over the line. So the fact that we were able to bring a player on the other side is huge, because obviously he was leaving for free anyway. I think it's a great signing. Clearly we wanted him before he went to United. Clearly he's wanted us since 2009 with that interview he did. So it's great that he's coming to a club that he likes. It's great that he's going to have a manager that will probably boost his confidence. You know, we know that Jose loves to hate on players, and it seems like that happened. And, you know, Arsene is a player's manager, and so the guy, when he has confidence, is unbelievable. And if we can even replicate a half of the seasons that he had with Dortmund, we've got a hell of a player. I like the fact that he knows the league. He's been embedded into it. He's had time to adjust. And I think he's the type of player that will fit in to our squad very well. I just don't know. I assume Iwobi will be the player to make way for him based off of form, but you never know with this management who's going to start, who's going to sit. So,
Tony, we've got one deal over the line, and I think Andy's response to the fact that this line, this deal got done so quick, I think is down to the fact that Man United wanted Alexis Sanchez more desperately, it feels like, than we want to get Aubameyang. What are your thoughts on the deal, and do you think that losing Alexis Sanchez was big enough a blow that even Henrik Mkhitaryan by himself as the only signing will not be enough?
No, it's difficult. A lot of, especially the match-going fan base, but the fan base around the world, wanted rid of Sanchez in a sense. It's one of them, it might be cutting your nose off to spite your face, but he damaged a lot of our attacking play, but he also had that X factor where he could score from nothing. And I don't think there's too many of our other players that can do that. Even Mesut, who I'd class as our best player, and I did class as our best player even when Alexis was still there. He could create something from nothing, but he wouldn't score from nothing. So I think, as I said, we're losing a bit of the X factor, or that magic touch, whatever you call it. But I think we could be better in general play, moving the ball quicker. But we're definitely less of a goal threat with Mkhitaryan in and Sanchez out. So, I mean, we spoke about this before, but just in terms of pure numbers, if you look at, I'm not saying football is, but if you look at it as like a money ball model, we're losing X amount of goals. We've got to replace them from somewhere. Could that be someone that's already at the club? I personally don't think so. I don't think there's enough goals from the players that are in and around the club. So it looks like it's going to have to come from outside. I would love nothing more than for Eddie Nketiah to be able to replace the goals that Alexis, that we've lost it with Alexis. But I don't see that happening, and I don't think any of us do. So you do have to replace the goals, but I believe we could be a more flowing team and we'll keep the ball better, which is always something that Arsenal have been sort of known for. Is, yeah, we might have been poor defensively, but you can half afford to be if the other team can't get the ball for you. If you've got 70-80% possession, then as much as I hate possession stats, it doesn't matter if your defenders are not focused the whole game, because most of the time they're only going to be getting the ball and passing it to their mate. Where Alexis's turnover was so high, I think the defenders always had to be on the ball. So it is bittersweet. We've lost an attacking threat, but I don't know if I believe it or I hope it. I think we'll become a better all-round team because of it. But we do need to bring someone in to replace them goals.
Better all-round team brings me to an interesting phenomena, which a lot of Arsenal fans have pointed out ever since Alexis' departure, and that has been the absence of any social media activity. I think Mustafi was the only one who put out something, and that too was two words, I think, good luck or something to the tune of that. But we saw some very friendly and some very gracious messages for Theo Walcott, for example, who also recently left the club. And we all, people who haven't heard Andy's reaction to that, please tune in to Gooners in the USA podcast. And that is something you guys must listen to. But Andy, what do you make of this whole thing about, you know, us being better without Alexis instantly, you know, that being because of the chemistry of the dressing room and the free-spirited, if you will, response to this?
Well, it's only been two matches, and I don't think we're going to see the long-term effect until the end of the season. But, you know, you hear about training ground match bust-ups between him and Jack. You hear about him kind of not being in that social circle. I think that you don't want to call him a cancer, as they often say over here in the U.S. to the locker room. But if he doesn't gel well, then, you know, it's better for him to leave. And I would love for a player at the club to also try and step up, but I don't think that player's there. But I think that with Sanchez leaving, you are removing a negative person from the locker room. And you got to give Sanchez credit. He never came out into the press. He never played the game of I'm the victim, I need to leave. He was always quiet. He gave a lot. He tried hard. But if your teammates are pissed, it speaks volumes. No one said goodbye outside of Mustafi. I mean, it absolutely speaks volumes. And when you see Coughlin leave, you see Theo leave, and both of those players pretty much get a farewell from everyone, I'd be interested to know, did Sanchez actually say good luck and farewell to either of those two? You know, and so good riddance to him. But I think it can only help our locker room. It really can. And then you see the El Nini tweet today about we finally have players here that care about this club. That speaks volumes as well. And so I think it can only help Arsenal. But as Tony had said, you got to replace his goals. And maybe that's why we're going hard for a striker who can do that. But yeah, sorry, long-winded.
No, I mean, you're right. And in fact, just another shout out to Mohamed Elneny, who was absolutely world-class yesterday. I think his best moment came after the game when, you know, when he was asked about Alexis Sanchez's departure, and he said, look, we're not a one-man team. And I think he showed that yesterday, you know, along with some other players. His desire yesterday was impeccable. I think you bring up a good point that, you know, I don't know if Alexis wished Theo and Coughlin, who left before him, but someone he did mention, and Tony, I'll come to you for this, is Thierry Henry. Walk me through that. What was he thinking?
Yeah, I mean, it. Obviously, he's come out. He's come out of a statement to sort of half retract what he was saying. So obviously, he said he pretty much insinuated that Omri advised him to leave. Which, whether true or not, and we're all going to have our different views on that. But whether true or not, you don't. Why throw him under the bus? It's got nothing to do with you. It's not going to make the Arsenal fans go, oh, well, Omri said it was okay, so we're happy with it. That's never going to happen. Even if the Pope or God himself or Allah or whatever higher being you believe in came down and told him to go, it still wouldn't make you happy about it. So I don't know. I don't really know what Sanchez was trying to achieve with that. Obviously, then Omri came out and said pretty much I've never spoke to him. But for me, I mean, the way I read it like when Wenger said he'd never heard of Cazorla. Because he distanced himself that much. It like, kind of seemed to me like, okay, you're going over the top now. And then Sanchez obviously kind of half retracted it via a tweet, and I'm not sure if it was on other social media. But what caught my eye, I thought it was quite funny. Jamie Carragher, who is obviously someone who works on Sky every week with Thierry Henry, quote tweeted Sanchez's tweet and like was acting like he was Alexis' PR man and said, tweet something like ... and then quoted Sanchez's tweet, which I found quite funny, but I also found it quite interesting. Like, I mean, it may have been Carragher having a laugh, but he works with Omri every week, so he has more of an idea of who Omri speaks to and whatnot. Do I believe Omri said to him, get out of the club, it's a rotten ship? No, but I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if they did have a conversation and Omri's, as I said, he's not said jump off, he's not said abandon ship, but I wouldn't be surprised if there was some, not backhanded advice, but there was like things maybe better elsewhere sort of talk. It's hard to know what to believe without being either of the two, really. So, yeah, I mean, as I said, it's difficult from the outside.
Andy, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, you know, if Sanchez had left for City, it's a different conversation, because you could almost say that Henry left for Barcelona because he knew the Champions League trophy would be in his future. If you're leaving for City, you can argue that Sanchez knew that Premier League and maybe a Champions League trophy was in his future, but he left for United, who have finished below us for the majority of the time Sanchez was here, and he's getting paid ridiculous money. And I don't think Mourinho will turn that team into a title challenging team, because he will implode before that happens. And we see it time. I mean, history repeats itself with that guy. So it's a weird one that he went to United. For me, it's driven by money. I'm sure he had a conversation with Henry. I'm sure that Henry was truthful with him and said, if you don't believe in this system, you've got a couple years left, go. But I also believe that if we had replaced Arsene a year or two ago, Sanchez would probably have signed an extension, because he would have gotten paid good money. He would have been at a big club in a big city, and there would have been a different build to the team. And I truly think, hand on heart, that if we had a different manager, he may have signed that extension, because he is driven by success. He is driven by being competitive, and I don't think he sees that in Arsene. Maybe he sees it in Mourinho, but we all know what Mourinho does. But I think, you know, had he gone to City, I would have been a little bit more inclined to think that Henry would have told him, hey, jump ship and go, because you have a better opportunity to win with Pep. But I don't see him saying that with Jose. I don't see him saying that with United.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's mostly down to the money that he chose United. I mean, if I'm honest, I don't think he had a conversation about that. I think what he tried to insinuate from that post is that he was trying to put himself in the same light that, look, Henry left for a reason, and their reason was trophies, and that's why I'm leaving. And to your point, Andy, I think if he had gone to City, I think that's perfectly acceptable to put there in your farewell message. He was very sweet to everyone at the club, the technical staff. He even praised people, you know, who cut the grass and everything. I think the whole thing was done in a very Alexis Sanchez, very fairy tale way. But that specific bit, I think he was trying to shed light on why he was leaving without saying it, because he knows how hypocritical it could have sounded. And just trying to, you know, bring focus to Henry, I think, you know, made me fume. I mean, I am absolutely fine with his departure. I never took a special liking to the guy. I'm just glad we got a good deal out of it, a decent deal out of it. But I think to bring that portion into it and to try and put yourself on the same pedestal as Thierry Henry for Arsenal fans is unacceptable. So I think that's where I probably differ with you a little bit. But I know why. I know Tony wanted to, you know, talk a little bit more about why this may have been the case, why Henry might have wanted Alexis to leave. And maybe that has something to do with the potential takeover. Is it, Tony?
I mean, I don't know, is the truth. And any takeover is, I would say, at least 2 years away. Maybe not that long, but it's when you're buying anything that big, it's already valued at over £2 billion. It's not going to happen overnight. So I don't think really this current batch would be in any of players would be in any takeover plans anyway, because it's, as I said, if it takes 2 years, unless, like, we've not got anyone who's in the team at the moment who's like sort of 21 promising, and looks like we've not got a 21-year-old Jack Wilshere. So if you had 2 years onto most of them players, they're either not going to be there or sort of hanging on to the arse end of their career. So I wouldn't think that has much to do with it. I personally wouldn't, but some people may draw that conclusion.
Moving on, some news that recently came out, just today, in fact, is about our new cryptocurrency partner, which is called Cash Betcoin. Apparently, this is the first football club. We are the first football club to get into a partnership with a cryptocurrency vendor. So, any thoughts on this, Andy?
I know nothing about cryptocurrency except for it is weird and I don't understand it. But there's a lot of money in it, so hopefully they're paying us a lot of money for this partnership.
Well, I would hope so as well, especially with these new headlines coming out about how we have a problem with our wages. Tony, what do you make of this?
I mean, it's interesting because we've always been well behind on commercial deals in terms of the number. Like, so I think I've mentioned this on here before. I've definitely said it before that we don't have a dugout sponsor anymore. It used to be Citroen. We don't have that. We so obviously United, I think it's still Audi or Chevrolet or whoever it is, but we don't have that. We're lacking in a hell of a lot of sponsorships. We don't have a sleeve sponsor, where I think it's 17 of the Premier League teams now have sleeve sponsors. So just in a number of commercial deals, we're lacking. And most teams have an official betting partner, which we do. Paddy Power, Betfair, they're the same company. I can't remember what one is pretending to sponsor us at the moment. All I'd be interested to know is if it's a new stream or if it comes under one of the others. So if, for example, I know it's not a betting company, but if, for example, it just replaced Paddy Power or Betfair, I wouldn't really be too interested in it, because it's a small growth. Whereas if they've come on board as an additional sponsor in a new market, which is new to football, then it is very interesting, because every part of that money is additional money, rather than just, say, if we used to get 5 million a year and we're now getting 8, it's only 3 million a year growth. Whereas if it's a new arm of sponsorship, then obviously we're getting the whole sum as an addition. So that would be interesting to know. But it is good we're looking sort of further afield. But I'm surprised they didn't. Like, I think there's so much commercial stuff to get in order. Like I've said, sleeve sponsors, dugout sponsors, that I thought they would have got them in first before looking at a new market. Like, we've even got an official watch sponsor. We've got, like, pretty much most things they'll have a watch, they'll have a sponsor. The club suits will be a sponsor, and they will be made by the same company. I'm not sure who that is. So they've got Thomas Cook as a travel sponsor. But yeah, we are severely lacking. So it is interesting they're bringing in a new arm, if that is indeed what they've done. But I mean, you'd think the dugout would be a pretty big one, and I can't believe, I think it's been 2 years now we've not had one.
Yeah, I think we need to start capitalizing on any of these deals that we can do and bring in some revenue. I think you're exactly right. Well, Andy, I know that you have to head out soon. So we had one question that I was saving for the end, because it made for some more serious talk, and I thought it wouldn't fit well into your introduction part. So Tez, who's spot on filling today, asked about Stan Kroenke. He says, you know, that he has a lot of teams that he owns, mm-hmm. and you are, of course, very well placed when it comes to that. So can you tell us more about what's the vibe with these fan bases? And if you can please pretend that you're Tom talking about with his ACL, that'd be fantastic.
So obviously in Denver, he owns the Denver Nuggets, the Colorado Avalanche, the Colorado Rapids, and he owns the Colorado Mammoth, which is a lacrosse team. The Rapids is actually pretty cool, because as you drive out, the flagpoles have a massive Arsenal crest and then the Rapids crest on either side. And then it wasn't there last time I was there, but they had a big cannon in the corner they shoot off with a big Arsenal flag over it. And so I think that partnership has been in place since the 90s. But the way he runs his teams and the way the fan bases are, it's very similar to Arsenal. So I'll use the Colorado Avalanche, because that's probably his second most supported team. It's a hockey NHL. They've had a couple Stanley Cups. His general manager is Joe Sakic, who is a legend. It'd be like having Thierry Henry run the club. For a while, he had a head coach, Patrick Waugh, who again would be like Patrick Vieira. So he put players into positions of power. Joe is still the GM, and Patrick he quit, and it was because the club wasn't going in the direction of his liking. So I think he puts a lot of yes men into powerful positions.
Surprise, surprise.
And exactly. And the fan bases are the ones who suffer. Interestingly, the Avalanche went from being the best team in the NHL to the worst for 2 years, and they brought in a very young coach. They invested in some very young players. They brought in some great depth, and we're seeing a massive turnaround this year. The Rams, that he owns the NFL team, I don't really follow them, but again, they brought in a young coach and saw some great success. But he surrounds himself with yes men. He surrounds himself with people that do the job because he doesn't want to be there. I have season tickets to the Avalanche. I don't think I've seen him or his son in their box for two seasons. And they sit right next to the GM, and he's there every match. And so I think it's he runs his clubs very much the same. He puts butts in seats. Interestingly, 2 years ago, the Avs had a particularly bad season, and they actually cut season ticket prices. They sent out an email about 2 months before the annual sign-up and said, we're going to cut the costs by $150, which is, you know, a lot of money. It depended on what level and tier you were at. But they cut by a percentage, which was very unheard of. And as you walked into the stadium for the first match, everyone got like a little beanie cap. And so there's a lot of similarities. And I think that, you know, when you see him and the way he runs Arsenal, you see it a lot in the way he runs these other teams. He wants to put butts in seats, and he doesn't really care about the results. We had kind of mentioned on our pod that, you know, maybe this turnaround with the Rams, maybe this turnaround with the Avalanche will kick him into gear with the Arsenal of saying, hey, look at these changes that were made from a coaching perspective and how fresh blood brought in success. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I'm at there. And it sucks that I'm supporting more than one Kroenke team, but hopefully the changes that he's seen in two of his larger franchises, he'll bring over to England.
Yeah, and I mean, we're seeing some changes already at the club, so it seems like that we are pulling our socks up before it gets too late. But Andy, I know you have to go, so...
I do. I'm sorry. I show up late and I have to leave early, but work calls, and so I really appreciate you guys having me on. We'd love to have you both on with one of our pods here in the future, and I'd love to come back as a guest if you have me, and if you have more time to listen to more pods, come over and give us a quick listen. Gooners in the USA, we don't try and take things too seriously, and there's a lot of dick jokes, and so if you're offended, don't listen, but we try and have a good time as much as we can.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Andy, for joining us.
Cheers. Cheers, guys. Pleasure meeting you both virtually, and I look forward to talking to you again.
Thank you.
Bye.
All right, guys, that was Andy, who you can find at Gooner in Denver, and you can listen to their podcast, which is Andy and Mike, at Gooners in the USA. Check them out. Those guys are a riot. All right, Tony, so it's just the two of us for the final part of our latest episode, and we'll be going through some questions that we received. We got a lot of questions, actually, so let's try and speed through these. Starting with some interesting talk about... ITKs and Moly. So our first question is from @BigChestDell, and he asks, are we going to have Moly Football on to discuss these transfers and Ozil Jack contract renewal? He goes on to say that do we even know if Steve Bould is allowed by Wenger to coach our defense?
So the first part about Moly, he ensures to me that once Aubameyang is confirmed, he will be appearing on the podcast. So that's as far as I know on that. Don't hold me to it. If he doesn't come on, it's not my fault. Blah, blah, blah. In terms of the coaching, it's a difficult one because, in all honesty, Steve Bould, I don't mean to belittle him. He didn't earn the job. Like, he just sort of became assistant. I think he was working with the youth team before that. So, and it's difficult to know what he's allowed to do and what he's not allowed to do. We're working into a different shape. We changed shape. So unless you want to say that was all Wenger, someone's got to say somewhere. But from the outside, I don't know who does what. We know Wenger's fiercely loyal. What we've defended in a different way over Wenger's reign. So unless he's just decided to change his mind at some point, you'd have to assume that someone's had a say in that. Is it Steve Bould? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a tough one. No one really knows how things work at Arsenal, and very few details come out, so it's very hard to say. Our next question is a little more tactical, and it comes from the Texas Gooner. He says, we've seen Granit Xhaka used in a variety of different roles. In central midfield, as a deep-lying playmaker, a pivot, interior in a three, is there any role that particularly stands out as his best to you? And which role do you prefer the least?
Just as a side note to this, because I forgot to say it earlier, Granit Xhaka last night was excellent defensively and quite poor with the ball. And I've said this over the last few weeks, that we was all moaning about his defensive work, and he seems to have really shored up with that and lost what was his strength before that. And I still maintain that if you can combine both, he'll be an absolutely unbelievable player. But again, he gets no credit for that defensive work. He made a great recovery tackle on Hazard when we was in big trouble, and there wasn't even like a... like usually tackles like that would be celebrated almost like a goal, but there wasn't, because it was him. It was just like, no one's mentioned it today. I've not seen a single mention of it on Twitter or anything. The role he's born to play, and again, I've touched on this before, is alongside a defensive midfielder, because you can use his range of passing, and anyone that thinks he can't pass the ball has, again, been watching a different player. There's been times when he's made sloppy mistakes, yes, but one of his key strengths is his passing. I was actually having this conversation with my brother last week, that you think, like, what player do you compare him to? I'm not saying he's as good as, but you kind of look at him as like a Xavi Alonso, or in terms of they're not defensive midfielders. They play deep, but they start the attacks from deep. But all of the players you compare him to, they had a defensive midfielder alongside them. Another one is Pirlo. And again, I'm not saying he's technically as good as Pirlo, because he's clearly not. But Pirlo had a Gattuso alongside him, or I can't remember who it was at Juventus, but he had a defensive midfielder alongside him. I think with Xhaka, we're trying to get him to play two roles, and he's kind of getting somewhere confused between the two. I do think his best position is next to an out-and-out defensive midfielder, but he also suffers from that being Jack Wilshere's best position. It's certainly Sani Cazorla's best position when fit, and I would prefer either of them two in that role, and I'm a Granit Xhaka fan, but I think in his strongest role, he wouldn't get anywhere near the team. So they've shoehorned him into a defensive midfielder role, which he's learning, maybe not as quick as we would like, but he is also still our best option there, and that's not his fault.
Speaking of that position, and we've seen Coquelin depart recently, so Savvy, how are you doing, Savvy? He chimes in with a question, and he asks that, do we need to replace Coquelin, or do you think that we have enough quality when it comes to Elneny and Niles?
It's a very difficult... well, it's not a difficult one. Coquelin didn't... I don't know how many Premier League minutes he played, but I'd imagine half of his Premier League minutes this season would have been a centre-back at Man City away. So what are you replacing? Someone that plays an hour in half the season? And I'm pretty sure you can afford Niles that time, Maitland-Niles that time. I think there's two questions in one here. Do we need a proper defensive midfielder? Probably, but as we've explained before, it's to play in that position for Arsenal is quite difficult, because you also need to be very good on the ball. So do we need a proper defensive midfielder? Probably. Do we need a replacement for Coquelin? Probably not, because, as I said, you're not really replacing anything. You're replacing an hour of football, and you might as well give a youth player a chance for that.
True. Speaking of Elneny and yesterday's game, we have a question from CET Scout, who asks, what did you make of the atmosphere at the Emirates last night? And he goes on to ask whether Hazard should have been sent off for in the second half.
I didn't think it was a sending off, first of all. I didn't think it at the time. Everyone around me did, and everyone around me was going mad. But the way he fell was natural, in that it wasn't a dive. That's what it looked like in the ground. And watching it back on the TV this morning when I woke up, it wasn't... I don't think he particularly appealed. And he looked to trip more than anything. As I said, it was very natural the way he went down, as if he'd stumbled. And I don't think there was a strong appeal. So I didn't, but everyone around me did. But whether they've seen that back and still believe that, or they've changed their mind, I don't know. But no, I didn't think it was sending off. The atmosphere, it's always going to be good against Chelsea. We've been sporting the last few games, because I was going to say this earlier when Andy was saying that the atmosphere was very good against Leicester, but there was obviously extenuating circumstances. Mm-hmm. That recently, the atmosphere has been very good at the Emirates, but if you look at the fixtures, we've had Chelsea twice in January. We had a 4-1 win, so the atmosphere, and all the goals were early, so it was always going to be a good atmosphere. And then before that, we had Liverpool at home, which was a 3-3. Again, you're always going to have an atmosphere in that kind of games. So the atmosphere has been very good recently, but thinking back to the game before the 3-3 against Liverpool, we beat Newcastle 1-0 with a very good goal from Mesut Ozil, but the atmosphere was not the best. So I'd be hesitant to say it's completely improving, but the football recently has lent itself to a good atmosphere.
Our next question is from Tony D, who is at Essex Tone, and this question sort of ties in with another question from at Apu underscore T. They both sort of talk about Jack, and they one of the questions asks, do you think Jack should be made captain? And Apu T throws in Jack and, Koscielny and Nacho in the mix as well. And also, there's a follow-up question to that, whether where Ramsey fits now that Jack has sort of taken that position and made his own over the last few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, everyone knows my feelings on Jack. I would actually give him the captaincy now. I know a lot of people say make him captain for next season, but I don't think you gain anything by waiting. As we discussed before, he's already a leader on the pitch. We was talking about Kante's systematic fouls, and Koscielny was captain last night, and I didn't see him go and have a word with the ref. Whereas Jack, maybe it was because he was a victim of the fouls, but was really getting in the ref's ear and letting the ref know that this was Kante's fourth, fifth and sixth foul. Whereas Koscielny wasn't. And as much as we all moan about players surrounding the ref, everyone else does it and it works. So it may be a bit of an arsehole-ish thing to say, but if everyone else does it and it works, you've got to join the party. You don't get anything from being the one that has the moral victory. I mean, that doesn't work for me. So, yeah, I'd give Jack the captaincy now, personally. In terms of Rambo, it is a very difficult one because, I mean, look, last two games, we started off yesterday with three in midfield and we started off with, well, we played the whole game against Palace with three in midfield. So in that way, Ramsey would get back into the team, which... If we're done in the transfer window, it will work because it will just be Ramsey in for Elneny, and Xhaka drop 5 yards deeper and Mkhitaryan in for Iwobi, and that will be our strongest 11 pretty much. If we have to revert to a 4-2-3-1 or a 5 at the back, then it's going to have to be Ramsey or Jack. And at the moment, Ramsey's... You can't drop Jack at the moment. And I am biased, but this isn't coming from a biased place. You simply cannot drop him the way he's playing at the moment. But he's not played a full season in a long, long time. So they are going to rotate, but is Ramsey going to be happy seeing that he's the second choice in that position? Probably not. So it's a headache, but it's probably a good one because we're talking about good players here. We're not talking about rotating two bang average players. We're talking about rotating very good footballers.
Yeah, and I mean, we know that Ramsey has sort of stalled on contract talks, so this is a good way for him to, you know, provide competition and, you know, earn his place in the team and then demand that high amount of contract. So if anything, as you said, it's a good headache. So I completely agree with you over there. Our next question comes from Akash Vijay, and he asks, why do Arsenal not include release clauses in any of our players' contracts?
There's no benefit to them. It only benefits a buyer, so I don't know why we would. And no one in England does. They're prominent, I was explaining before, in Spain you have to have them. It's customary. You have no option, and in some teams go ridiculous. So they'll buy a player for $500,000 and say, "Oh, his release clause is $900 million," knowing full well that obviously that's not going to happen. I'd probably say that's what Barcelona thought they were doing with Neymar when they put $200 in. I can't remember exactly what they brought him for. I think it was between $30 and $40, and they thought, "Oh, there's never going to be a £200 million footballer." Bear in mind, I think the record at that time was $80 million, so you're talking another sort of 250%. But yeah, so in Spain you have to have them. Here you don't. And as I said, there's no benefit. I would like to know why he would want us to put them in, because it never suits us. You'd either have to go ridiculously high just to stop anyone matching it, or risk losing players for an amount you don't really want to. Or it's that you don't have any say. That's the problem. Is that, say, Ozil had a 90 million release clause. If you signed a contract for 90 million release clause, receiving 90 million for him may be a good fee. It may not. But you don't have a say in it, which is the worst thing. If a club offers 90 million, be it Man United, be it Tottenham, if they offer 90 million, you'd have to go, yeah, okay, go and talk to him. And there's no benefit for the club.
Yeah. Akash, you should get in touch with us and tell us your thought behind it. because we would like to know more why that question is bothering you. So I think it will make for some interesting discussion. Moving on, Akash has another question for us, and I think we will slowly move into transfers unless I have missed out on some questions. But Akash asks again about Toby Alderweireld, who came up in our last episode. He basically lays out some figures and, you know, talks about contracts, but the essence of his question is that if you're going in for someone like Johnny Evans, why don't we maybe take it up a notch and go in for someone like Toby Alderweireld?
Toby Alderweireld's a very good player, very, very good player. Got 18 months left, but we've seen with Oxlade-Chamberlain that only 6 months seems to make a difference now. I think Wenger was half right when he said it's going to become more common for players to run their contracts down. Because before 4 years ago, a Chamberlain with 12 months left would barely have attracted a fee. Now he was what, 35, 40 million pound player with 12 months left. So with 18 months left, you'd still be looking at paying a full fee, and you have to add to that it's Tottenham and they would probably reject anything from us under 70. I would say he's probably a 50 million pound footballer in current market. In all fairness, for me, he's much better than Van Dijk. So you start looking at that fee and you say 75 million, and then you add the premium on because it's us. So that would either be not accepting any price, or you'd have to be looking at over 100 million pound. And would I, as much as I rate him and I think he's probably the best in the league, would I pay that for him? No, is the simple answer. I can see where the question's coming from, because he is a very good player, and it looks like 18 months less, we could offer more wages, which we could, because he's not being paid much, which is why he's having the contract dispute with Tottenham. But as I said, when you factor in his Tottenham and then you look at prices of what all players, but especially defenders, you've got Laporte going to City for roughly 57 million, Van Dijk's just gone for 75. And then you add the Arsenal-Tottenham premium tax on, and it becomes crazy.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's quite ludicrous in terms of how much it costs. The next few gentlemen that we are supposed to discuss on request of ABD are Evans, Thomas Kadar, and Seri. Any updates on them?
So Evans... it was always billed as a race between us and City, with him seeming to prefer City. Obviously, if they do complete Laporte, then it leaves him gettable. It leaves us unchallenged, but obviously you still have to match a price. That figure's believed to be around 20 million, which in this market, I'm not saying he's the best defender in the world, but you struggle to get Championship players for 20 million at the moment. And that may sound like a joke, but it's not far off. I know... I think it was Newcastle. Fulham got a number 10, Tom Kearney, and I think Newcastle offered 20 million in the summer and it got rejected. And another team, I want to say Crystal Palace, but I might be wrong, have bid 17 million for him today or yesterday, and it's been rejected out of hand. So 20 million, you don't really get a Championship player these days, or you get, albeit a top-end Championship player, but Johnny Evans is a lot better than that. So it looks like he'll be available for 20 million. His agent is demanding £4 million or a 20% fee. We tend to work on 7%. So he's demanding 4 million. We'd be looking at paying him about 1.5. So that would obviously be a stumbling block. The wages wouldn't be extortionate. So I think there's a real chance of that happening. I wouldn't go and put money on it, and I would advise none of our listeners to. But I think there's a chance of Evans happening, to be honest. Kadar, the link seems to come from nowhere. It's one that, to be honest, I don't know enough about it, because it just seemed to be so left field. I don't really know where it came from. So it's hard for me to speculate on it. I don't know much sort of behind the deal about who's competing for him, what money you'd want, if there's a big agent's fee or whatnot. So it would be difficult for me to comment on that. And Seri, he's never been an option for us. This one has literally completely been born of fans in the summer, just saying we should go for Seri. It'd be perfect for us. And I don't think he would. And Arsenal have ruled it out so many times. But his name still keeps cropping up. I don't really know why. But no, he's not a option for us.
Another two names that keep popping up every now and then are Lucas Perez and Joel Campbell. And James AFC at James AFC 10 asks, when we have a clear shortage of wingers, why wouldn't we recall some of these players back from loan?
I think over the last... So was it last March we changed shape? We don't play with wingers. I saw this question, and both of them are inverted as well, which almost narrows you more. If you're bringing them in as wingers, you want them to be touchline wingers, and where both of them play on the right and they're both heavily left-footed, it narrows you down quite a lot anyway. But yeah, we don't really play with wingers, so it's not... I mean, like, neither of them are going to come back anyway, and you've also got to factor in that if a fee was paid for them, which I'm pretty sure both of them was, they were both loaned at a fee, we would have to pay at least that fee, if not more, to get them back. And I know a lot of clubs hate doing it, and it tends to not happen because they hate paying fees back for their own players. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to pay a fee to get them back, you've got to be looking for them to go in the team. Like, I dare say if there's an injury crisis and Iwobi, Welbeck and pretty much everyone else that could play behind the striker got injured, then we may be tempted to pay that fee for one of the two to get them back because there's a crisis. But unless they're going to come back and get into the team and play a significant role, you're not going to want to pay for that. I mean, say we paid $4 million to get Lucas Perez back. We're pretty sure he's going to be sold in the summer. So even if you then get... You've got to remember, we spent $18 million on him, and then you've got to add that $4 million on that we've paid to get him back. And you're probably only going to get $10 million for him in the summer. So is he going to do enough in them months to justify, in the 3 months that are left of the season, to justify that? The chances are probably not, because he wouldn't get his space in the team. So for me, it wouldn't make sense. I can see where the question's coming from, but one, I think is extremely unlikely, and two, I don't really think it makes sense.
Extremely unlikely, you say, and that brings us really well into our next question, which is, of course, about Aubameyang.
Who's Aubameyang? I've never heard of him.
I know, right? No reports coming out of Germany at all today. It's been all quiet. But this question does come with a little bit of a twist, so it's interesting, and I hadn't thought of it this way, so maybe you can shed some light on it. This is from @big_bad_wolf and other underscore after that. So Big Bad Wolf asks, why do you think we're going in for a 29-year-old? Is it possible that Arsenal will insert a hefty release clause in his contract just in case Real Madrid or a Chinese club come knocking?
Again, why would you? It comes under the similar as answering the last question about release clauses. If you put, say, £150 million release clause in there, that means they could offer £100 million and get away with it. That doesn't... If you don't have a release clause, you could reject everything up to £150 million anyway. So a release clause only guarantees that you have to sell for that price, but we could settle for that price anyway. And also with a release clause, it's not like you have to reject anything under that. So you could put £150 million release clause in and they could come and offer £120 million and you're still going to sell him in reality. So again, a release clause is there to the detriment of the club. I don't know if it's become fancy because teams do it in European football, but a lot of people seem to be mentioning them. And there is no benefit to any club to put a release clause in a contract.
Very well. And our final question for tonight is from @LDizUK. That's @LDIZZUK. And he or she asks, why does Tony think that Wenger will leave at the end of the season? Apart from all the background changes and everything else, is there something else that is niggling that in you?
Look, the background changes do have a big part to play in it. But I said they're a huge part of it. But also, I don't know, it's just a feeling I get. There's no, and I've said this before, there's absolutely no information that surrounds this. It's just a feeling I get, even in his interviews. He seems to be a lot more snappy with the press. He's always, even with referees, like, he's always had a dig at the referees, but he seems to just be very short and very snappy. And it's like, I don't want to say he feels like he's had enough, or whether the pressure of the fans maybe wanting him out, or the press hounding everything he does. I just don't know if it's all got to the point where he thinks, like, this is nonsense. And maybe he hasn't, but I just get the feeling that he maybe thinks his time. I still maintain that I don't think the board will get rid of him. I think it'll be his decision. But just a feeling I get with all these interviews, with the setup changes, it maybe seems like the rug's being pulled from under his feet a little bit, and he'll jump before he's tripped over.
Do you think there was a possibility that this contract was signed with the knowledge that maybe after a year, the two parties could part ways on mutual terms that were, perhaps already agreed or sort of spoken about? Just to sort of avoid, you know, the last few months. I mean, we saw last season, right, how it was so much of a distraction. So maybe to avoid that whole scenario, perhaps?
Yeah, I was just going to, that's what I was just going to bring up. I've heard it brought up before for that very reason, that if he signs for two with the gentleman's agreement to go after one, he avoids all the questions. I'd be surprised if that was the case. I'm not completely ruling it out. But then I think that, as I said, the current snappiness and the obvious displeasure at the change in system, backroom-wise, wouldn't bother him if he was sort of pre-warned about that, which it doesn't seem to have been. I mean, even when he signed the contract, there was a lot of talk that Gazidis wanted to change everything, and Wenger sort of flat-out refused, pretty much. That was when Mark Overmars was linked with the director of football or sporting director job, and it was reported that Wenger flat-out refused. So if he would have signed with that agreement, as we just spoke about, I don't think he'd have been refusing them sort of things, because he would have thought, oh, the club are building for the future without me, so they're putting a system in place for when I'm not here. And also, I don't think he'd have shown, I don't want to say obvious displeasure, because he's not come out ranting about it, but I think it's pretty clear to see he's not a fan of the new setup. And if he knew that was only for three months, pretty much by the time the season ends, I think ends early May this year due to the World Cup, so three and a half months. I don't think he'd be showing displeasure if he knew that this is the next 3.5 months and then I'm off to pastures new. So I have heard that theory bandied about, but it's not one I think is true, but I don't know that.
Yeah, I think your guesses are as good as ours. I mean, it's a feeling that Tony has, and of course, it's difficult to rationalize something like that. But we'll see how things unfold at the end of this season, and maybe with all these signings, Arsene Wenger will see out the remainder of his contract. Maybe not. It's hard to say. But of course, we all have our eyes on that. So I think that brings us to a wrap, Tony. We've gone over for about almost 1.5 hours, and I'm glad Andy was able to join us. For everyone listening, go give him a follow at Gooner in Denver, and you can find Andy and Mike's podcast at Gooners in the USA. They're always retweeting our stuff. We're always retweeting their stuff, so you can also find them at our Twitter page. Let us know how you guys enjoyed today's show. If there's anyone's questions I've missed, it's probably because we've gone over them already, or it's purely my mistake. So do give me shit for that, and I'll make sure that we address that question next time out. As always, Tony, wonderful chatting. Thank you so much for joining me.
No worries. Can I just say a big thank you to not only all of our listeners, but also all the people that are asking the questions. And also, I think now more than ever, we're getting more questions, but we're also getting a lot of people saying, like, when's it out? I can't wait to hear it. I can't wait to hear you guys' views. So thank you to everyone for not only listening and contributing, but also genuinely liking our product. I mean, we do it for you guys. So if everyone was hating it, we wouldn't be here. So thank you for taking the time out of your busy weeks, doing whatever you're doing, to listen to me ramble on about what me and Schwinn and anyone else that joins us on the podcast ramble our thoughts on this wonderful club.
Thank you for that. And thank you for reminding me of that. And that, I think that deserves a shout out for @Rishi_Arsenal, who sent us a tweet about that. Rishi, we're going to try and do our best to get that pod hopefully to you soon, and hopefully you're listening to this soon. But that's Tez. So if you're late with this, then you should go talk to him about it. But anyway, go give Andy a follow once again, and go give Gooners in the USA a follow. All right, Tony, I'll talk to you soon, and we'll have something for our listeners perhaps this weekend where we do a transfer roundup. If there's not a whole lot of activity, then we'll see how to proceed. But we'll keep you guys posted. Thanks for listening. Thank you for downloading. Henrik Mkhitaryan is a gunner. Bye-bye.